Rob Ferret filling in for Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks a lot for joining us this morning. Larry's going to be back tomorrow, by the way. He's going to talk about Labor Day grilling fun with Mad Dog and Merrill. And at 11:45, you know the voice of Badger football, Matt LePay. He'll talk about his book, Why Not Wisconsin? From Barry to Bow, broadcasting the Badgers from the best seat in the house. Right now, we are turning to talk of the weather. And the weather guys are here. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, professor of atmospheric sciences. He joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And then we also have John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the UW-Madison. Caught you just as you're drinking some water.
Yeah, hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good. Well, I think the hot weather news right now has got to be Hurricane Isaac. Or Tropical Storm Isaac, where is it right now?
It's on the threshold of going from tropical storm to hurricane. It's taken a while to get out of the tropical storm category. I think the winds have been over 60 knots for a large part of the last 24 hours, maybe as many as 12 or 18 of those hours. And that's somewhat uncommon. These things usually can kind of quickly transfer to the hurricane status. But it's on its way. It's in exactly the right spot to do it. So It's going to turn into a big storm.
It's in the Gulf with a lot of warm sea surface temperatures.
Yeah, and deep ocean heat content. So it's right where it wants to be.
We'll talk about where it's going in a minute, but it didn't have as much of an impact on Florida as people worried about, except for bumping back the Republican convention a little bit.
Yeah.
What did it bring to Florida on the way by?
Rain.
Yeah, rain. It wasn't even quite as bad as people had expected in Key West, but that was about as bad as it got on the Keys. And then maybe some gusts around 40 to 50 miles per hour a couple of times, but sustained winds were pretty low.
Yeah.
And now it's headed toward the Gulf Coast on or near the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Yes. That's got to have a lot of people worried there.
But it's not quite nearly as intense as what a Katrina was when it hit the Gulf Coast. So I think they're still bordering on looking at hitting the coast at like a Category 1, which, Katrina was actually a Category 4 when it hit, didn't it?
Well, almost.
It was a Category 5.
It was Category 4 and 5 storm out over the Gulf of Mexico, and it weakened as it came on shore. And I think the actual sustained winds kind of suggested it might have been a Category 2 storm when it hit the coast. But,
there's a lot of damage.
20 inches of rain are forecast for Lake Pontchartrain and environs over the next couple of days. That's a lot of rain.
Yeah.
And, they've got trouble with where that water goes in New Orleans.
Right, and they're already talking about some evacuations in areas near and parishes near New Orleans. I don't think New Orleans itself yet.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the science behind that. It's a tropical storm. It's cruising along the Gulf. What's happening that raises the intensity?
A couple of things happen. That as the storm gets more intense in terms of its the individual thunderstorms that make up the periphery of the storm, the so-called eye wall convection, as they get more intense, the circulation around the storm gets more intense because the pressure in the middle gets lowered fairly dramatically. And as the pressure in the middle gets lower, then the air from around the periphery of the storm rushes towards that region of lower pressure, and that's what really spins the winds up. So we're waiting to see the pressures begin to drop rapidly. They've been dropping modestly over the last 12 or 18 hours, but not rapidly, and that's, I think, been a factor in keeping the storm from developing rapidly. But that's probably the major thing. And the way that it does that, the way those thunderstorms get more energized is they stop interacting with the topography of Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Cuba. The thing went along the northern spine of Cuba, which is a rough, island. And then when it gets out over the Gulf, the Straits of Florida, the water is warm. The depth of the warm water is pretty deep, so there's a lot of energy stored in that water that goes right into the storms that fuel the hurricane, and that's what we're kind of seeing right now.
And this is typical hurricane season right now, right? Or is this a little early?
No, this is the season. It runs from June to November and usually peaking in this time frame.
Yeah, a couple of weeks
August,
or so
September.
From now. Yeah.
Yes,
2nd, 13th or 14th of September is the peak day on the 100-year chart or something.
And every year there's the prediction of how many hurricanes and how many major hurricanes we can expect. Are those usually pretty on target?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. I think in 2005, when the Katrina year, they were way off because that was a really anomalous year. But generally, they're generally pretty good. I mean, NOAA was forecasting 12 to 17 named storms, and I think we're already up to 10, right?
Yeah, we're up to 10. So that's probably going to be a decent forecast. So that's really a statistical forecast based on a few parameters. I think that's not so hard to get in the ballpark there, although Steve says 2005 was way off the charts. But the number that hit the U.S. or turned into major storms, I think that's just about guesswork based on some statistics, and there's no real good way to get a sense of that. But the 10 to 17 is a good guess.
It's the intensity of these storms that still remains the hardest thing to forecast. Yeah,
absolutely.
Whether you're talking seasonal or even 24 hours.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I've seen some talk about how much rain will go inland even after this thing is past the Gulf Coast. How far north do these rains get?
Remember in August of, was it 2007, we had a major rain event here that was out ahead of a dying tropical storm that kind of completely dissipated by the time it got to Oklahoma. So one can't necessarily say that heavy rains in southern Wisconsin or central Wisconsin are directly related to a tropical storm or a hurricane that makes landfall, but they are strongly indirectly related at worst, and maybe even one could make the argument that they're directly related. So I saw all the way through, I think, Saturday morning a forecast now that has 3, 4, or 5 inches of rain in southern Iowa. And then the forecast, of course, stops at that point. It just didn't go into Sunday. But during the day Saturday into Sunday, we may well see rain here that is unusually heavy, indirectly a consequence of the path of the storm, right?
Rob Ferret filling in for Larry Mueller. And I am talking to the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. You can join in with your weather questions at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Whether they're about hurricanes or something closer to home in Wisconsin, love to hear what's on your mind when it comes to the weather. 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Well, I work on the political shows here a lot, and I remember about 4 years back, the state Democratic convention was disrupted by the big flooding we had. Does weather hate politicians?
Everyone else does.
Right? Why not? Maybe they don't like,
No,
it's politicians who don't recognize science,
yeah,
which is the way to put it.
It's curious, though, that I think, you know, it's enshrined in the Constitution that we're going to have national elections in November, the second Tuesday after the first Monday in November or whatever it is. And so that kind of sets you up, being an agrarian country at our founding. You have to wait till the fall to do all this important political business. And yet it's unusual, well, not unusual, it's just unfortunate that our country is subject to substantial weather variations at that time of year. And so when you have your party conventions and various other things, they tend to occur not only in places people like to visit, Florida, but also at the time of year where Florida is maybe a place to avoid because yeah. you can find yourself in the middle of a hurricane path or something. So it's an unusual set of circumstances.
Yeah. Any prospects for anything disrupting the Democratic convention coming up in a week?
Well, there's no there's an area of investigation out over the Atlantic right now, which is this sort of precursor of a potential tropical event. But in places like Asheville and other parts of North Carolina have not, been spared hurricanes in the past. So it's possible. It doesn't seem likely right now.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to spend probably the next half hour honing in on Wisconsin a little more, but I wanted to go from way south to way north. I just pulled this off the computer before I went on the air. A warm Arctic sets a record for summer sea ice melt.
Yeah.
You've probably seen that. What's going on up there?
Yep. This is the time of the season in the summertime when the Arctic oceans warm up. We get lots of solar energy in there, and the ice sheets move, melt back. So that's the normal cycle. Mm-hmm. But with the global warming that's occurring, not only the size of the ice sheet, but also the thickness of it has been decreasing. So it's enabled a much more rapid evaporation or sublimation or melting, however you want to call it, of the ice sheets up there. So yeah, right now we're at a minimum, and I think headed to beating the all-time minimum of 2007.
It wasn't that long ago. And it's always, again, second week of September. It's almost perfectly coincides with the peak of the hurricane season is when the ice gets at its minimal aerial extent. One of the weird things that's happened maybe this year that somebody commented on, and it's directly related to what Steve just said, the thinness of the Arctic ice at higher latitude currently than used to be the case 50 years ago. If you have relatively thin, fragile ice and you have some pretty major cyclone or some windstorm come by, that can crack the ice up. And that's actually what's happened over the last couple of weeks. Really powerful storms, which are not particularly unusual at that high latitude at this time of year, operating over relatively unusually thin ice. And that is a bad combination. And once you open the water up, then there's much more rapid ice loss.
Yeah.
So
is this something we ought to be losing sleep over?
Okay. There's not much I lose sleep over anymore, considering how little I get. But it's just another indication that global warming is happening, is real, independent of what some politicians say. And the question is, are, you know, we going to directly address it, or are we going to directly not address it? And that's the kind of sad part.
Right. I agree with that.
And I've heard that one worry with that advanced ice melt, check me if I have this wrong, is that it changes the salinity of the ocean in northern latitudes, and that changes circulation, and that can really change weather patterns over multiple continents.
That's very true. There's it's not a an inconsequential change to melt a lot of ice, and so it can be changes in the circulation, especially in the North Atlantic. Is a very, very sensitive spot for ocean circulations, at least in the Atlantic Basin, and can't screw around with the salinity up there. That's just one of the factors that drives the circulation.
And how much does the ice come back then over the winter? And does it come back to a thinner state than it did last year and the year before and the year before?
I think I've heard that it comes back to cover almost the same area every year. Now,
but
I don't think
thinner,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, mid-February ice extent has decreased, but it isn't as huge as the September extent, but it's thinner, and that's bad because it sets you up for failure in the next summer.
Yeah, so it's that, yeah, it's having to build that new ice each year that takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, you know, it's wintertime up there, so there's no sun, so it gets cold, and so the ice does form, but yeah, it doesn't have enough time to build on existing ice.
Just a minute before we take a break, is there anything comparable going on at the South Pole in Antarctica?
In Antarctica, you don't get as much as a seasonal cycle in the ice sheet as you do in the Arctic. What we've had in the past is complete collapses of ice sheets. So it seems to be a much more dramatic event. You know, like you'll see it there, and then it'll thin out, and you'll get some puddles of water on it, and then the whole thing will just collapse.
Mm. And on the continent itself, you don't get the feedback of having a water underneath the ice, which is a really big problem in the northern oceans because, as we were talking about, you know, if you get thin ice and your storm comes over, it can just crack it up.
Yeah.
So we're on thin ice.
That's right.
Rob Ferret filling in for Larry Mueller today. We're talking to the weather guys this hour, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, both study the weather, meteorology, and climate here at UW-Madison. We've been spanning the globe from north to south and some hurricanes in there. If you have questions about those things or anything closer to home here in Wisconsin, you can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And you can always go to the Larry Mueller Facebook page, find out what's coming up for the rest of the week there, but also leave your comments and your questions. Larry's going to be back tomorrow. He's got some grilling lined up with Mad Dog and Merrill. And then he'll talk to Matt LePay, the voice of the Badgers, talking about his new book, Why Not Wisconsin? From Barry to Beau, Broadcasting the Badgers from the Best Seat in the House. More to come talking about the weather. And if you're already on the line, stick around. We're going to get to your questions coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about weather this half hour, from the mundane and seasonal to the out of the ordinary, unusual, and fascinating. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in today for Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network, and we have the weather guys with us. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences. And John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. We'll get to your calls now with Brian in Burma. Hi, Brian.
Yes, hi.
What's your question?
Well, I was looking at the water temps on Lake Superior, and I have some friends up there in the snow belt, and we've been hearing about an El Nino winter, a mild El Nino, and they say it doesn't affect them up there, and with the water temperatures this high, they think there's going to be heavy lake effect snow. I was just wondering what you guys think.
Yeah, the temperatures of Lake Superior are really above normal. It's very warm. Lake this time of year in comparison to climate. And yeah, when winter sets in, when you get those cold air outbreaks going over that warm water, it's going to generate a lot of snowfall downwind. And El Nino is a very weak one right now, so it's just starting to develop. But I haven't heard any forecasts of what it's anticipated to be come our winter time. Because yeah, when we're under strong El Nino conditions, we don't get as much snowfall up in Wisconsin, which is very depressing for people who like to go skiing like myself.
Yeah. And it might be that it'll be interesting to see this year if the warm lake means the onset of the lake effect snow season is earlier, or if it's just more intense during its normal time, or both. I'm kind of thinking it might start to show up a little bit earlier. What used to be lake effect drizzle in late October might be lake effect snow this year. That'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I guess it's the real, it's the temperature difference
it's
between the
yeah.
lake and the air, not just the temperature of the water.
That's right. Yeah, but you raise that, that's great, because you don't have to have the air quite as cold
quite
to
as
get
cold
something
to get
happen.
It.
So,
yeah.
I spent a lot of time in Lake Superior every day last week, and warm and Lake Superior, those are very relative terms.
Yeah, that's right.
It took 3 minutes longer before I lost the feeling in my toes.
Yeah, right.
So right. Was that 3.5 minutes? Is
that exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Is that a worry that Lake Superior is so darn warm this year?
I mean, it depends on what you mean by worry. I mean, we've been seeing a slight warming of that lake with time. And, you know, when you start warming up any of the Great Lakes in a climate sense, that's going to impact the ecosystem for sure.
Mm-hmm. Plus, the circulation of the lake is probably dependent on not getting the top surface layer too warm, because that makes it very stably stratified and you can't mix nutrients and you can't mix other things up in the lake until the winter comes. And let's just say the winter is not that intense. Then you can go over a whole season without having lost as much energy off the lake, and you start the spring with a fairly stratified lake, which is unusual.
Right.
That's not what you want, because then I think you really start to have trouble in the biology of the lake, at least the upper part of it. So, yeah, these things build from one year to the next. They can be bad, but it may not have any consequence at all.
Thanks for the call and the question, Brian. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the weather? We've got the weather guys here to answer your questions. Patrick in Prairie du Chien is up next. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. I've noticed this phenomena twice this summer, once in June and once last week. I was walking quite early in the morning. I live out here in the country, and it was foggy, and twice I saw these rainbows, but they were made of fog. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Hmm. Yeah, it's called a fog bow.
Really?
Yeah, and it's formed the same way that a rainbow is, except the fog droplets are smaller, and so you don't get a separation of the colors. So what you see is like a white band, right? Is that what you were saying?
Exactly.
Yeah, yep.
Exactly.
And I have looked for one my entire life after I heard about them, and I have not seen them. So the fact that you've seen them twice
makes him upset.
Very jealous.
They're fascinating. They're small. They're probably, 60 feet wide. Okay?
Yeah, they're very narrow to the ground, long arc, and very narrow in size, yeah.
Well, I want to see one of those now.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Patrick. So you're jealous. Have you seen one, John?
No, I'm jealous, too. I've not seen one. It sounds like you can put it in your pocket and run away with it.
That sounds nice.
I'm pretty sure there's no gold at the end. Maybe
yeah,
there's
right.
silver at the end.
Right. Yeah. Right. Or ice at the end.
Or ice at the
yeah.
end.
Thanks for the call, Patrick. Daniel is with us now in Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. In coverage of the long-term drought in the West, it was stated the vapor pressure deficit had increased by 50% in New Mexico, which they seem to think was extraordinary. Would you explain vapor pressure deficit?
Yeah, I think it's the difference between the vapor pressure of the air, and that is pressure exerted just by the water vapor molecules that are in the air, versus the vapor pressure that's inside trees, various other types of plants, and so on. And the difference between those two testifies to how fast those plants and maybe dead trees and things like that that present a fire hazard may actually be losing water and therefore becoming more flammable. So to have a big rise in the vapor pressure deficit is bad news. It makes those fuels even more potent.
So this isn't a matter of not enough rain in and of itself. It's already dry, and now this deficit is actually sucking moisture out of everything you
exactly
don't want to
right.
catch fire.
Exactly
yeah.
right.
Oh, and maybe vegetation, too.
And vegetation, even living things
the
yeah,
crops.
That you're trying to grow. Right, that's right.
Yeah, things dry out really fast.
Great question, Daniel. And here's a good follow-up from Kathy in Cloverland. She emails, after this dry summer in Wisconsin, what's the forecast for the upcoming winter? We touched on lake effect snow up north, but what about the rest of us?
The seasonal forecasts are always tough to do, but what the National Weather Service is forecasting for our seasonal upcoming late fall and winter is above normal temperatures, and they're pretty confident about that. And back to precipitation, I mean, it's the hardest thing to forecast. They don't really know.
Yeah.
So it could go either way.
And it's important to remind people that this is not the same thing as the 1 to 2 day forecast or even tomorrow's forecast of the position of Hurricane Isaac. That is a deterministic forecast. These are statistical forecasts, and so they really shouldn't be considered the same thing.
Yeah.
But they're better than the Farmer's Almanac as far as reliability?
Anything's better than the Farmer's Almanac.
Even my forecasts are better than the Farmer's Almanac.
Anything is better than that.
Call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the weather? We had full lines, but if you caught a busy signal earlier, we've had a couple open up. 800-642-1234. Rob Ferret here, in for Larry Mueller, talking to the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Back to your calls now with Bob in West Allis. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I noticed that the temperature on the Pacific coast, they said, has some effect upon the amount of moisture that the that this country might be receiving. I noticed also that in Japan and some other areas, they've had a surplus of water, of rain, and I'm wondering if the water temperature or ocean temperature has had an effect on either situation.
Yeah, I think in terms of impacting us, for sure, because most of the storm systems we get, particularly as we enter into fall and winter, move from west to east. And so if they can pass over warm water, just like hurricanes, they can that warm water evaporates into the storm and can be transported over to the Midwest.
Yeah, that's right. And I know that Japan is bearing down right now or actually just had a near approach of a major typhoon, and there's another one behind it that's not quite as strong that maybe is going to head in the same way. So it's been a pretty rough month of August for parts of Eastern Asia. And that has some impact on our weather, and especially maybe the weather on the west coast of the United States, by influencing the way the Pacific jet stream is structured. And we're trying to figure that connection out right now. So the things you point out are definitely connected. We don't know exactly how yet.
And let me ask a weather 101 question. You mentioned that weather tends to move from west to east. And, of course, I noticed that watching weather maps and motion satellites and stuff. Why does it move west to east in this continent?
Well, it moves west to east in the middle latitudes on both hemispheres of the planet. Mm-hmm. One of the main reasons is that the planet actually rotates in that direction, so that helps. Although that's not the major thing. And then it's colder at both of the poles, North Pole and South Pole, and that sets up a pressure gradient that points towards the poles in both hemispheres. And the wind is the best part of the wind, 80% of the wind is pretty much perpendicular to that direction of where the pressure gets lower. And so that's going to be from west to east. It has to do with the circulation of the rotation of the planet and the distribution of temperature on it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Back to the phones now with Kyle in Milwaukee. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to go back a little bit and touch on why the temperatures either nationally or regionally were going to be warmer on average than they were in the years past. I'm a little short on time, but basically why these winter temperatures are forecasted to be higher on the average. Is it primarily because of the weather that we're experiencing now, or is this a trend that we're going to be seeing in the future?
Well, there are two answers to that. One is, in the future, there's definitely a trending for a global warming nationally. In looking at the seasonal forecast, where we're seeing a high probability of warmer than normal temperatures for the upper Midwest, that's not the case for the Southwest. I think they're forecasting lower than expected temperatures. And part of that is the anticipated, as John was saying, statistical inference of what the jet pattern might look like given today's conditions or the summer's conditions, what the weak El Nino that's developing is doing as well.
Yeah, so that is more determined by the current conditions, as Steve says, not so much the long-term global warming. Though, as you point out correctly, they're both occurring.
Right.
And so long-term, we're going to be warmer 25 years from now in the wintertime than we are currently.
Kyle was talking about warmer than expected, I think, winter temperatures. Where are we around Wisconsin as far as breaking records for 90-degree days?
Oh.
I think we've got some warming coming up later this week, at least in central Wisconsin.
Yesterday was kind of rainy. Saturday was our 35th day at 90 or above at the airport in Madison. That ties 1988's record, which is in second place now. The all-time is 40 such days in 1955. But at that time, we weren't measuring at Truax at the airport, so it was a different measuring site. But so what? We've only got 5 days to go to break the record, but we're getting awfully close. I mean, we're going, as you said, Rob, we're going to have about three of them at the end of this week, so we should be in the very high 30s by the time this week ends. We need one more wave of heat to get there, and it sounds like it isn't that much, but there were years, I think year 2000, we didn't get a single day above 90 until September 2nd, and that was the only one of the year. So
yeah,
we may be done at 38. I'd hate to finish second after this long hot summer. But
I was actually surprised at how few 90-degree days we generally get.
Yeah, it's nothing like this number. Yeah. This is at least three or four times the normal average. Yeah.
Do you weather people root for records to be broken?
Always. I don't care. I mean, I do. I don't know about Steve. Yeah. Every record that comes across, I want it broken. That's what they're there for. Yeah, absolutely.
When you get close to it, you know. Yeah. If you would have started out the beginning of the summer and asked me, do you want to have a record number 90-degree days, I would have absolutely said no.
No, oh, that's right.
Now
that's
we get close, it's kind of like, let's go.
I agree with that,
too. If you're going to get close, you might as well break.
We've endured, right, we've endured it.
This is like DiMaggio's hitting streak. We don't want to get this close and not get there. We don't want to do that.
Back to the phones now. We have Vivian in Milwaukee. Hi, Vivian. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And this does not sound local, but it is. I'm in Milwaukee. And the Urban Ecology Center of Milwaukee is sponsoring a trip in the first 2 weeks of September to Alaska, to Anchorage, Seward, and mostly to Denali National Park. And I'm wondering about the conditions, the general conditions, but also you were just talking about the it's being warmer or more ice melt this summer. Last winter was one of the coldest, snowiest in Anchorage and south of Anchorage in a long time. So are there any kind of general patterns that you can see? Or if I want to get some ideas, just go online and look for the averages in the past.
Yeah, that's probably your best bet. I don't know off the top of my head. I do know that I went to graduate school in Seattle, Washington, which is pretty far away from the peninsula of Alaska, but it's as close as any other place in the U.S. They purposely don't start school until the end of September because the weather is so gorgeous in the Pacific Northwest through the month of September. I don't know if it extends that far north to the panhandle of Alaska, and Denali, of course, is outside the panhandle, but if it does, you're in for a treat. But not knowing the answer to that, I think it probably would be best to kind of consult maybe the Weather Service webpage at Anchorage or someplace like that. They'll give you a sense of the long-term climatology there that there's at least a foot in the door on what you might expect.
Yeah. Do you have some room to bring us along with you, Vivian?
I would like to follow. I really recommend Urban Ecology Center. If you're not familiar with it, go online. They have fantastic educational programs, and they are a gift to the state. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, have a great trip, Vivian. That sounds like a lot of fun. Hey, weather guys, one thing I didn't want to forget. I watched some videos of these water spouts on Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
I've never seen one. I don't know that I'd actually want to see one except on my computer screen. Seven of them over a weekend this month? What are they?
And there were five of them in that one image, I'm looking at the same one you were. That was just amazing.
Yeah.
Thunderstorms that kind of rumbled a little bit south of us in Madison, I think, that day, and then they ended up going out to sea south of Milwaukee, Kenosha. And I guess they were just spectacular water spout. They're like dust devils / tornadoes. They're not as strong as a tornado, but they're a little more potent than a dust devil. And they usually form in a convective thunderstorm environment. And over the lake, it isn't so hard to get a little whirlwind going, I guess. Apparently, they're fairly common.
Yeah, when you get to this type of the season, August, September, and October is actually the peak time to see water spouts. And it's because the water is reaching
pretty
its
warm,
warmest
temperature.
And you get that gradient again between the cool air. And that helps to generate, just like in a dust devil, that temperature gradient helps to generate these beautiful water spouts.
Gorgeous picture that was. And you can see them in the wintertime. Then they're kind of called steam devils. They're not as deep, but they're steam coming off the lake. And they get, especially in Duluth, just to the downwind side of the bluffs on the north side of the lakefront there, that they can have steam devils that are several hundred feet high.
Yeah.
Dramatic.
And doesn't even have to be a storm to make one of these things happen, or do you need a storm to make it?
They generally have two types. One where they call a tornadic, and that's like a very weak tornado associated with a strong storm. And then the second time is called a fair weather waterspout. And so, yeah, they're just like associated with cumulus type clouds, not very severe. Yeah, and that's the kind they get a lot of those in Florida.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I think the ones we saw in Lake Michigan were the tornadic variety, because that was a pretty well organized convective storm. Yeah,
which is probably why you had so many.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Back to the phones now with your questions for the weather guys. Steve in Adams County is with us. Hi, Steve.
Hi. The night before last, I was watching the rain that we got that night and yesterday approach Adams County from the west on NOAA's radar maps. And when it reached the Wisconsin River by Adams County, where we have a couple of large flowages, Peyton Well and Castle Rock, it seemed to hold up there while the further north and further south it continued east, and then it finally broke across. But I was wondering if bodies of water can interrupt the movement of a storm, or at least an area of precipitation, rather mild precipitation like that we had.
Yeah, my first instinct is that they can't, especially river bodies of water. I mean, big lakes can have some influence on individual precipitation bands, but I don't think rivers have much of an influence. What might, though, is the topography surrounding the river. And so sometimes you get, especially at Castle Rock, is an interesting spot because they routinely get a really weird low temperature in some locations. It's a really deep valley there or something. So it could be the topography surrounding that portion of the Wisconsin River that's more of an influence than the water itself. Almost surely that's the case.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good explanation. Mm. Yeah.
And can bodies, and obviously we were talking earlier about hurricanes, where a body of water can provide more energy. I sometimes watch storms go from Wisconsin to my home state of Michigan, and it looks like they're picking up some steam over Lake Michigan. Does that happen?
Yeah, when you have a big body of water, then, yeah, you have an increased evaporation to the storm, and that can help feed energy. But generally, rivers aren't going to be that big. They're not going to really help in terms of feeding a storm. They'll have local effects like fog and things develop.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure.
But not impact thunderstorms in particular.
Yeah. And how about Lake Winnebago? Is that big enough to do anything, to juice up a storm, or
could
still
juice
too small?
Up a thunderstorm? You know, when it comes across from Appleton and headed toward Green Bay, maybe it picks up just a little bit of extra water vapor. But again, as Steve was pointing out with respect to the waterspouts, that effect, if it exists at all, is going to be really at its peak right now, late August, September, when the water is as warm as it's going to be all year. So it's very seasonal.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Brian is with us now in Hayward. Hi there, Brian.
Hello.
What's your question?
Hey, I'm currently constructing a new home, and I'm thinking about putting in a geothermal heat pump system, and I'd like to find out just exactly where I could go to get data as to typical frost depth so I can determine how deep I have to bury my geo lines.
All right.
And this is up, actually, it's in northern Douglas County.
Okay.
Where's a good place to go for that kind of information on your local frost levels?
For frost levels, you might be able to find something in NOAA or the National Weather Service. But I would think for what you're thinking about, that you probably want to maybe look at the DNR or some energy place.
Because
you want to get it's not just you want to get below the frost level, right? You want to get down to where that temperature is 55 or whatever and not changing. You don't want to have any real annual cycle, I don't think.
Right. I think that defeats the purpose otherwise.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And wouldn't somebody who's, who builds in the North Woods area would probably know that information? I don't know where they'd get it. Steve's suggestion's a good one, but there may be even more detailed commercial information from some building association or something like that, some giant corporation that's building things up there all the time. So that's another source that you might be able to
find it. Yeah.
Well, how much do frost levels vary from year to year? Because I think of a really warm winter, like the last one we had. I mean, are we talking a few inches from year to year or feet?
I think you'd be talking feet.
Yeah,
you know, in
so
particular,
too.
A cold winter with no snow, that ground's going to get frozen and go a long way down.
You
know, a relatively warm with a lot of snow, which will insulate the ground, you could have a very shallow frost layer.
That's right.
A deep freeze layer.
Yeah. Maybe agricultural interests would know, too. Certainly they would, because they pay attention to that.
That's true. Yeah, local farmers may be able to tell you.
They'll tell you what the variation could even be and what the extremes have been in the last 5, 10, whatever year, amount of years.
So that might be something for the county extension office up there in Douglas County.
Another
actually,
place. Yeah.
If they don't know, they probably know who does know.
Yeah, actually, that's
really,
a great
that's probably the best place to
okay.
go.
All right, well,
they'll
it's a
get
good
you
thought.
The most information.
Well, good luck on that project, Brian. Sounds like you got a lot of work ahead of you and a little bit of research before you get there.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that we could use geothermal heating in our houses in Wisconsin. It's not normally something I think about.
Yeah.
You usually think of that like in Yellowstone area.
So, right.
But yeah, they work.
So I'm sure a lot of people were wishing they had it this summer when we had 35 days over 90.
It would be nice to be putting in 55 degrees.
55 degrees for no cost except to lift it.
Right.
Really short on time. I just wonder, we talked about fog bows earlier. One thing you guys haven't seen. Is there another weather holy grail in just a couple words that you want to see that's on your weather bucket list? John?
Yeah, I've never seen a landfalling hurricane. And I went home in the fall of 1985 from St. Louis to try and intercept Hurricane Gloria, and it fell apart. So I would still like to see a landfalling hurricane. I've never seen one.
Yeah, and I've always wanted to see an upper tangent arc, and I actually saw that in the Colorado Mountains this weekend.
So you're done.
So well, I'm now I've got to find another
yeah,
optical
all right,
effect.
Good, yeah.
I still haven't seen the fog bow.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Weather Guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. We've been talking about the weather, and they'll be back next month to do the same when Larry's back. Stick around. Chapter a Day is coming up. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.